Okay, we're gonna go ahead and get started. Good afternoon, everybody. Hope you've been having a good conference so far. This session is entitled Unplugged. What that basically means is we're going to construct a talk together. Basically, it's an opportunity for us to do interactive Q&A about Microsoft, Azure, .NET, Visual Studio, probably those sorts of areas. Those are areas I'm an expert in. I was going to start off with just a couple of context slides up front, but I only have two, so I'm not going to have a long slide deck. I'm going to switch over and I'll explain where we go next, but we're going to build up a set of questions, and then we'll do some demos and other things like that based upon what you'd like to talk about. So from that perspective, this is your session. Now, what I wanted to start off with was a couple of things. One, just from context, and we talked about this morning, I wanted to show the layers that we have in a different sort of view. Now, we talked a lot about the global infrastructure that we've made available, all the new data centers that are going around. We will continue to add more and more data centers as we go for worldwide. Now, on top of this is where we have three big areas. So those building blocks that I talked about this morning. We concentrate a lot on having compute, the networking, and storage. The compute piece obviously powers all of our platform as a service, things like websites, virtual machines, that sort of content. The storage system we talked about this morning is for holding on to all sorts of memory. And there again, we have three primary pieces. We have both blob storage, the NoSQL table storage, in addition to having queues used for programming, so those sort of pieces. And then finally, networking. One of the big things that we're investing heavily in is both physical networking for our infrastructure, obviously all of our routers and switches, the top-of-rack switches on top of clusters, but in addition to that, software-defined networking. So our software load balancer, our SNAT, or software network address table, all these sorts of things. We put all that software in there for you. We package this stuff up and then give you all of those components that are built on top. And we'll actually build things on top of these as well. So I mentioned, for example, that virtual machines, the virtual disks, are stored on top of Azure Storage itself. When you saw, for example, the demos of doing things like mobile services, we have SQL Azure, databases, those are also stored on top of storage. So you can write directly against it, and we can use it as part of our own systems too. And then finally, we have the open source and .NET frameworks that sit on top of the stack. I'm not going to start writing applications against the entire piece. So those are all the building blocks. Those are the components that we can use to construct applications. Next question is around the architecture. And I talked about this morning, but I wanted to outline it a little bit more because I think it's interesting to the sort of apps that we're building. So first of all, how do we combine these things? And now let's switch gears and think about how am I going to build applications? How would I construct those? The first piece is to have some kind of infrastructure that is going to be present. When I mentioned flexibility, these are good examples. So we have examples where you can run on-premises workloads. This is where I have something, source code, maybe I've been building for 20 years, and I'm not going to go rewrite it. I have a huge investment in that. But I want to actually make it available and publish it out to the cloud or provide other applications for it. And I might also, of course, put things into a hoster, or I may put things into the public cloud. But I've actually seen many cases where you'll have more than one of these, and you actually want to compose them together. Now, on top of that, being able to build out and providing access with WebLogic is a nice kind of pattern. And I suspect most people are moving in this direction already if you haven't, but being able to expose that set of APIs helps me, because by the time I'm done, I'm going to have all sorts of different client devices that want to connect to it. So we make it easy with web APIs, REST, OData, JSON are good examples. In ASP.NET, if you have not already tried it out yet, the new web API controller is a fantastic way to get this done. Because now I can actually use MVC routing, and I can create addressable endpoints on the internet, and I can use the JSON serializer that's built in, and I can program using .NET, and I can actually create arrays, objects, graphs, whatever I'd like, and then have those automatically translated back using web APIs. So this is a good pattern. So now I can construct and put the bulk of my business logic down here and expose it in a much more of a standard kind of way. Now, identity federation is the next piece. So once I've got this, I have to have security. I have to have authentication. I'll be able to pull that in. We've got Azure Active Directory based on AD, or Active Directory. Turns out about 95% of the world's enterprises and users are stored in Active Directory. It's a huge percentage. Being able to aggregate that back up into the cloud gives you direct access. This means I can do logins where people can use their corporate ID and be able to log in to remote applications. This will also federate with other environments. In the States, we use Facebook, Twitter, Google, a lot of these sort of things. We also provide support for other social networks, and we have standards-based support. So OAuth, SAML, these sort of prototypes can actually, or protocols, can be used to connect together. Then I can get to my connected device experience. And many of you might be using a couple of different approaches. Some people might be using more cross heterogeneous solutions or that allow me to build one version of the application and some kind of a runtime that allows me to distribute. That certainly gives you the ability to write a particular set of code for it, but once again, I'm accessing it through security and also the same set of APIs. In other cases, you may be building native clients for each. So Visual Studio for Windows, Windows Phone, might be using Xcode for iOS, might be using Eclipse to build against the Android ecosystem. But being able to build in this sort of format, again, I can now make smaller clients and I can connect them back to the back end. We've actually played with the presentation technology a lot. We have tried strategies where we've tried to build one universal view that just kind of works. My experience with this is, in general, you want to build a nice UI to match your form factor. And the navigation and layout for a small screen on a phone is significantly different than a big 30-inch high DPI monitor, which of course we also support with Windows 8. And tablets is the same kind of idea. A common navigation pattern, master detail, for example. In a phone, I can have a list. If I click on something, I want to pop up details. If I have a tablet, I want to put those two things side by side and make good usage of it. And we have API and HTML flow with ASP.NET, so web protocols that allow you to do that, but those are two good combinations. And finally, as I mentioned, being able to hook this back up with external services. In this case, I happen to have shown Facebook and Twitter as an example. However, any social network that may be popular, and obviously in different parts of the world, there are different networks that we may all be associated with to be able to connect with. And so, we want to have support for that too. And then finally, tying it all together, you want to have application lifecycle management. This is where we showed before how to integrate teams together and be able to do the continuous, integration, continuous deployment, those sort of contents, and be able to do this. Very typically in this environment, we will build a back-end service and we might have different teams. So I'll have a team that is releasing the service on a very regular basis and doing API versioning forwards and backwards compatibility. And you may have different teams then working on the rich clients, depending upon the size of the project, in which case I'm going to be releasing at different cadences. And so getting the versioning right, getting the protocols right, obviously a super tricky thing to get done, very important for that. Anyway, those were my two slides that we had that I just wanted to provide a little bit more context on some of the stuff that I talked about this morning. So now we get to the part where we build the talk together, which really relies on everybody here to be able to help out with that. So three steps that we have for this. Step number one, rather than doing a long kind of question and answer bouncing around the room, what I want to do is collect a set of questions that you may have up front. Pick your topic. So we're going to grab those. What I would ask is we have a couple of folks with microphones in the back. And so if you can raise your hand when you have a question, then we'll bring the microphone over. That is both for the translation piece But in addition to that, for the streaming component, so that people that are watching online will have an opportunity to hear what the questions are as well. So we appreciate your help. Next thing, we're going to group all the questions by different subject areas. So if we have a lot of questions on one area, we'll put those things together and build those. And then, finally, we'll go through and start answering all those questions. And then we can do follow-up. So if I didn't quite get your question right or answered the wrong question, just raise your hand again, and we'll go after that. I'm going to use an incredibly high-tech piece of software called Notepad to get us going. So, with that, yes, sir, right here. And I have my, we do have translation too, so if you want like listen to this too.
In Russian, yeah?
Yes.
Historically, Windows Azure has been developed as a PaaS, public cloud. And it was quite recently that you finally released from beta your virtual machines, persistence for virtual machines, and finally we got IaaS functionality in the cloud. Because our company builds a software for Windows RT to manage public clouds, and we've already done that for Amazon. I'm interested to learn about the future of Windows Azure as IaaS, because there are still lots of things to do.
Should I speak in English or Russian?
You can pick either. We have translation.
Okay. So basically, from what I've seen, Azure is configured using the Azure Management Portal, which is a web tool. So you can go there and click it by mouse and then sit up and tweak all your stuff. But this is maybe not something that many companies want in a corporate environment where you want to version and control the changes to the environment. For example, if you want to add some instances or go from a free instance to reserved or vice versa, then you want to see what was the impact and what, and then roll back quickly or move forward if you don't like the result. So is there a way to do this? First, is there a way to version the setup? And second, if there is a way to make the setup go automatically using a kind of a command line tool, which basically picks up a set of like XML files or whatever, and then make sure that the setup is in line with what is in the XML files, which are versioned. So we can rely that everything is exactly as we expected, that no one has made any occasional change that was not really took in mind when people assumed the next versions of the system.
Yep. Okay, great.
My name is Ruslan. I am founder of Jelastic. It's a cloud for Java and PHP applications. So I would like to ask you about private cloud options. Could you tell us a little bit more what it is? And can I install this on my own hardware? Can I use hybrid options? Or what is it?
Okay.
Thank
Great.
You.
Yeah, can answer that? Right over here. And we'll grab about 5 minutes worth of questions up front, and then we'll go from there. So we won't keep going forever.
Okay, I have second one.
Yes.
Right now, either we have such services like systems under App Controller, where I'm able to deploy a pretty complex service in my private cloud, but I'm unable to deploy the same complex service in Windows Azure, unfortunately, only one VM from image, when I will be able to create a real hybrid solution and, for example, migrate my complex structure, persistent, for example, as a service template in private cloud and in VMM, then push it to Windows Azure with no any issues. When I can do it?
Okay, great. Okay.
Hi, I have a additional question. The question is, how many people work on Azure? What is the process of development and testing? And what tools and libraries, how many other instruments do you use in your work to make quality instruments and services? Thanks.
Okay.
This may be just a follow-up to the previous question. I heard that the Windows Asia team is run by Scott Guthrie. Not sure if it's true. But what I also heard is that a lot of folks who work for ASP.NET and other related technologies are also part of this Asia team. So can you tell us a bit more of what is the relevance of the teams who make Azure and who make the tools or the ASP.NET or the other development tools, and what is the driving engine here? Like, whether you do Azure for your ASP.NET and other platforms and other products, or vice versa. So how do you plan those things? How do you manage the team?
Okay, great, great. Okay, cool. Any additional questions? We'll line these up and we can start. I always wear blue, but Scott wears red. Okay, tell you what, let me go ahead and organize these through and then we'll get started, and then we can collect a different set after that. Let's see, PaaS, deploy. What I'm going to do is sort these. Okay, yeah, deploy. This is similar to deploy. Private cloud. And Azure internal. Let's take these. These are straightforward. And let me do this one first because it provides context for these other ones. And then we can talk about that. All right, so let me go ahead and start on this. Move this out of the way for just a second. Okay, so the first set of questions here are more around the team, how is this set up, and that kind of stuff. You know, from a team perspective, Microsoft has what we call dev, test, and program management as three different components. Program management is where we often work with outbound product planning. We'll work on user specifications and user interface. What should it look like? For the Windows Azure team, Scott Guthrie is in charge of program management. So he runs the program management side of Windows Azure. Okay. Because that's more of an outbound, you see Scott will do plenty of speeches. He's very good at it, so we have him out there quite a bit. Scott and I are peers, and so I own the development team. So I'm in charge for things like architecture, the developers that implement the software itself, and from a DevOps model, making sure that we keep all of our services up and running and going. We actually have a third person that we're peers with. His name is Bharat, and he owns our test team. And the test team is responsible for doing a lot of our quality work. So basically, we have three of us running Windows Azure, both with the different functionalities. And then we report in through Satya Nadella, who's the president of Server and Tools. So that's basically the structure. So you're going to see Scott a lot because Scott is going to do a lot of talks. He's got the blog. Oftentimes, when we release new functionality, we'll actually explain it on Scott's blog. We'll do other talks. It's a good avenue for us to educate folks in what they do. And Scott would be the first to tell you that a lot of the cool innovations that we have an opportunity to show off are coming from some of the great people on the team. And so we subdivide after that because the next question was like, well, how do you guys organize this stuff? What we basically do, because it's actually a very large team. I mean, anytime you have thousands of people working on a product, that's a lot of engineers. And that'll actually tie into the question around the process sort of components. We have to subdivide it in order for that to work. And so we have top-level directors, also dev, test, and PM, and they run each of the different portions of the system. So, for example, we have a storage team with dev, test, and PM. We have a team that works on ASP.NET, dev, test, and PM. And then we have teams that work on virtual machines, infrastructure, and that kind of stuff. So it basically repeats itself all the way down through. So on my team, for example, I have actually a dev director in charge of building ASP.NET, mobile services, and that kind of stuff. He's actually here. His name is Dimitri Robson. He's originally from the area and will actually be giving talks this week. So he's a dev director, works for me. He has a counterpart in program management that works for Scott. So you get the basic idea. So nonetheless, the big thing is when we group the teams together, then we're able to pull together the entire system. Now, the next question was really around, what tools are we using and what process do we wind up following? As you can imagine, there's a significant amount of technology required to pull some of this off. So let's just take virtual machines for a moment. We have to actually go build out the technology to deploy host servers across all the machines. So there's an underlying piece on top of the physical system. So there's teams working on the actual physical hardware, the physical networking, and getting hosts deployed across, you know, could be 10,000 nodes. And there's information that has to come back. On top of that, I need to be able to store all the VHDs, the virtual machine descriptions, etc. So we have to be able to hook up to storage and get the background accounts in there and working. We get up on top of that, then there's the provisioning aspect. Like, say you ask for a virtual machine, where do you go schedule it? Because, you know, we want to make sure that we're allocating it to the right set of machines. We want to balance the amount of usage that's on the machine so you don't wind up with a noisy neighbor problem. So we have to have features that go off and decide for this request where's the best machine to go schedule it against, both for regions as well as the kind of noise level. There's also then the issue around how do I make sure that I can keep availability. So if you picture in your mind a physical data center where I've got racks of machines, each coming in with a different power supply, you know, we know hardware might wind up failing. Power can go out. In fact, just last week, we had an outage, which was quite interesting. It happened in our Singapore data center. And the issue that we ran into, it turns out that we had a power surge. So if you ever had the case, actually saw this in the hotel bar last night, where the lights kind of dim, they flickered, kind of went out, came back on, went in pretty quick. That happens, right? It turns out that depending upon which vendor you buy, your rack may not come back. It may go down. So we had some vendors where the racks that hit this power, you know, fluctuation that went through, they actually weathered it just fine. They had enough capacitance in there. They were keep going, and the machines kept going. But then after that, we had others that went down. They shut down. And when they were supposed to come back up, we had problems with transfer switches. So the UPCs, the transfer switch is supposed to go, supposed to get supply, supposed to get up and running. Didn't. Okay, how do you go do that? So in those circumstances, we want to design for that by doing what we call update domains and fault domains. That means we have extra copies of the data on different racks. So if one of them goes down, we can fault over to the other. That's how we keep higher availability. So as you can imagine, right there is a bunch of technology that has to get built in order to schedule it and keep it going. And then you get back all the way up into the portal. How do I make the portal easy and those sorts of things? So that's basically, you know, kind of the structure, how the teams come together. There's a question around, hey, how do you kind of plan and coordinate this? So if you've got, say, 1,000 developers on a team, 1,000 developers is a lot of people, and it's worldwide, right? Because we have people that are working on the left, mid, and right coast of the United States. We have people in Europe. We have people that are working also out of China, out of India, on different sort of topics. So how the heck do you make this thing work? A few different things. One, we do actually do some level of high-level planning. We typically will do that on a six-month boundary. It turns out a bunch of Microsoft works the same way. We try and do these around the big themes. These are cases like the example I just gave, where I need multiple teams to come together. And the feature doesn't work until I get it all done. So the question is, how do you coordinate that? We'll actually break it down usually into about six-month boundaries and identify what the pieces are going to look like when we get done. Now, within those, we'll pick the target and say, hey, you know, let's take virtual machines. The original goal was to get to preview. How do you get to preview? We had to pick the initial set of features I just described and say, in the next 6 months, we're going to have the basic set of that stuff working. Within that, we can now break it down into smaller milestones. Once we get into the smaller milestones, then we can distribute out to the actual teams, and the teams don't actually have to then do a lot of extra coordination at the top level. And so this is where we get down to what I talked about this morning, where we wind up having smaller teams that are able to ship once a week or once every 3 weeks. It really depends. As an example, for the teams that ship the portal, the user interface that you see, it's ASP.NET, .NET application, basically posted up just like a normal website. For that type of interface, we can actually ship that one very, very quickly. We can do A/B testing on it. We can ship new versions because the protocols underneath, like the design was shown, are actually pretty straightforward. Now, for the storage team, as you can imagine, I don't want the storage team shipping every week. When I ran the .NET team, I did not want the garbage collector and the compiler shipping every week. Because when's the last time C# made an if statement go the wrong direction? You had that problem? I hope not. I hope not. You should never have that. I mean, but think about it. Like when you're working on these lower level engine components, you're working on the compiler. Part of what it's supposed to do is figure out if the if statement's true, you go down to this block or else you go down to this block. So if you have compilers, garbage collections, storage, if these guys are shipping very regularly and introduce bugs, the whole system comes down. And the other problem with something like storage, if you get this wrong, then you can have some really, really bad problems. You can erase data. And so we've actually had examples of outages, you know, kind of test scenarios, where some kind of control plane on a test cluster accidentally did a format against the hard drive. Now, the good news is I actually have people on my team, on the dev team, that actually worked in Windows and built NTFS, NTFS, the file system, and actually wrote an unformat command. Have you ever written one of those? Yeah. It's fun. So it turns out, it's actually pretty interesting, it turns out you can go in and look at the table, because the format as it goes in erases the master block table, the table up front that describes where the files are. If you know the format, you can come back in and recover it, and you can kind of look for the other data structures, and you can basically unformat a disk. I wouldn't recommend doing that. It's not for the faint of heart. But, you know, so that's, it's just an example. And it's mostly to say that what I wind up doing is then splitting up the work. We have stuff that can go very fast. We have stuff that we want to be more intentional about. That's where we're going to do, you know, much more work on making sure that the stuff is up to speed and do extra quality testing. Now, with respect to the tools, we actually have a significant number of tools. A lot of them are actually internal. So we will use Visual Studio to do a lot of development. For example, walk back in here. We will use Visual Studio, of course. And let me change my screensaver so we don't start timing out. I have an IT department, too, and they like to do that. So we'll use Visual Studio to go build applications. We have both MS Build, which is the tools that are used for build inside of Visual Studio. And those, of course, will kick things out. We actually have, frankly, too many test systems. We're probably very much like you, which is hopefully you look at what we've got with TFS, visualstudio.net, and you say, wow, I'd sure love to go use all of that. That looks awesome. That's what I want you to say. Now, the truth sometimes is, hey, that may be great for a new app that I want to go write, but I'm not always writing new apps, right? So I have existing assets. We're the same. We have a bunch of internal tools that we've had since the earth cooled, which is a long time. So we integrate those into the process as well. But by the time we're done, every check-in will be validated. We do static analysis against it. We look for code churn. We do all sorts of other sorts of analysis that are more around geopolitical and those sorts of things as well. Run it through the system. We do these builds up in the cloud, pull them back down. We have unit test harness that will run all of the unit testing as well. And then we have what we call flighting systems, which is like your A and B, the stuff that I mentioned this morning. And what that means is the most efficient teams can actually do builds very quickly, large code bases in under 10 minutes because of the branching structure. They can actually get their unit tests run, and they can actually deploy by the next day. The deployment goes off, and it gets kicked off and can run out in the product, in the production environment, and we can go back and actually test it. And then that allows us to go back and turn it on. So basically, it's a lot of the same techniques and things that I talked about this morning that we make available as part of the product. It's just at a scale that we're talking about. You know, you may have 200 people on a particular team, and they may own a 5 million line source code base. The oldest source code base at Microsoft that I've owned is the C++ compiler. The first versions of the C++ compiler date back to 1988. We, of course, update it every year, add new features, but it's a lot of code. So I know many of you have a big code base too, and that's where we basically sit. Okay, great. And feel free to raise your hand if you have any follow-up questions or issues with that. Otherwise, I'll move on to the next section. So the private cloud. The question was asked about private cloud. Here's what we're doing. We use a combination of Windows Server and Hyper-V, as well as SQL Server. That set of technologies allow us to have the same kind of environment that we're running in the cloud. For Azure, we're also using Windows Server and Hyper-V to do a lot of our provisioning for virtual machines. The PaaS offerings that we create, so creating a web service, Internally, we still have a virtual machine. We allocate those. It's a good division of sub-allocation. We can do things like throttle I/O. We can do things like actual controlling the amount of storage and usage, RAM, those sorts of things. So we'll actually divide in that mode. Now, we have service definitions that allow you to actually say, this is what a machine should look like. Because we're using the same formats in both locations, it means that if you create a virtual machine, a virtual disk, you can actually migrate it. It literally is like a file copy. And so I can pull the file from one location, I can move it into another, and then I can run it. So that means I can use it in a public cloud, I can use it in a private cloud, and I can use it, which is your own data center, or I can use it inside of a hoster that's running the same technology stack. So we can move these things back and forth. Now, what we're trying to do with what we call the Cloud OS is say, here's a common set of functionality. If you write an application against it, you can actually make it work in all of those environments. You'll see some good examples of this. This portal that I showed up here, this portal that has all the input in there, we actually run exactly the same code that we've got exposed in Windows Azure. We run the same thing in this private cloud solution, which means that that portal can actually be deployed and run on your own data center. The website support that we have works the same way. So if you build out websites, I can run it either locally or I can run it in the cloud. Service bus and service bus relay, another couple of good examples of how you can combine those things back together. So we have a lot of good examples. SQL Server, another good example. So I can actually write an application that targets that set of technology. Once I get my application up and running, I can take the same app and I can move it back up into the cloud and make that available. So hopefully that answers the kind of private cloud, what it kind of looks like. Maybe not to the triple click, but closer. Yeah, okay. So that's the technology. So when you hear us talk about Cloud OS, this flexibility thing, that's what we're going for, right? It really comes down to, depending upon where you're at, what I'm seeing is a lot of enterprises, a lot of customers, they're looking at a combination of strategies. I like the idea of the cloud, I like the cost, but I need to figure out when I can move. I'm not going to do it all at once, and I have complications. In some cases, it may be a case where there's just not a lot of confidence yet, and I just want to try it out. I want to try projects and make sure it works. In other cases, it has to do with some subset of my projects or my customers, where maybe there's regulatory reasons for it. I know here in Russia, there are a particular set of data that really are not allowed to leave the Russian Federation, right? It needs to be here. That's a government regulation. And that's not unique to Russia. That's true for Germany, China, many other locations around the world. So, there may be legitimate circumstances where I want this kind of flexibility. You should think about this as you're going to find cloud vendors that are going to tell you, hey, just go ahead and move it up into the public cloud, or use my public cloud, that's what I offer. Here's machines, go ahead and do it. And if you can figure out how to move it around, good for you, but I do public cloud. You'll find vendors that basically say, look, I'm about the private cloud. I want to put some stuff over here, and we think that's really where the benefit is. And there's going to be some open source stuff that will also say, hey, we think we can actually make it work everywhere. Try it this way, and these five partners are going to come together to make it work. So we'll see. The good news for us is that's good competition, right? I mean, that means there's a set of scenarios that are being tried out. People are trying to figure out what the right path forward is. What we're trying to do with Microsoft is, since we've been building enterprise products for 20 years, right? You're probably already using Windows Server, SQL Server, etc. So we want to make sure that same technology can work for you. So we believe we're actually pretty well positioned to deliver that flexibility that I just described. Okay. So let's talk about the roadmap thing. So we started off with PaaS. I think you pointed out you kind of changed your mind. You did this infrastructure thing, what's up with that? So you did one before the other, and what's your kind of plan and that sort of thing. We definitely, you're right, we did start off with our platform as a service offering. And I actually think that as you watch people migrate, a lot of the workloads right now, we're seeing, there's absolutely a lot of interest in building PaaS, and we have a lot of good scenarios like that. Okay, but then what we're also finding is that you need some kind of a bridge to help. Not everybody's ready to do it. I mentioned, you know, that before. And so being able to expose the virtual machine functionality, which we actually did build internally. We actually did have virtual machines. It supports our PaaS offering. And we had a lot of requests saying, can you give me that? I would like to have that. So that's when we brought it out, did the preview, and now have brought it into market so people can use it as well. What I see is a combination of a lot of people will come in and say, look, the infrastructure as a service, the virtual machines, is a great way for me to get started. I can use existing workloads, I can pull them through. But I have new projects that I want to go target the platforms, and I want to be able to write against it. Because this elastic scale, being able to auto-scale up, just basically set the limiter and say, I'm willing to have 8 boxes working on this, but I only want to pay for 1 if that's all I need. You either have to go build that technology, or we can build it for you. And so, for example, internally, we do the same thing. Our internal systems that actually manage where the machines are, which ones are up, which ones are down, we actually do implement that software as a service itself. Now, we've got an internal implementation of Paxos. We can run active instances where we replicate the state across all these clusters. Just think about it. When you go off and create a new virtual machine, the last thing you want is you created the virtual machine over here, and the stack goes down, and this guy doesn't know about it. Your machine's been lost. What happened? Well, you need high availability. So we have internal systems to kind of force that through, and we use those internally. But with something like the PaaS offering, we actually build that in. And so things like load balancing instances, like if you want to pay attention to where everything is, you can do it. You have full control. But I actually think that programming model where you get these other benefits is actually really cool. And so we have a lot of people in there. So you're going to see a combination of people using infrastructure as a service plus using platform as a service. And you're going to be able to mix these things together. And I actually think that's going to be a very popular programming version of this. I'll give you one case study that's probably interesting to a lot of folks. There's a case study we've published with EasyJet. EasyJet is an airline corporation. And they have an example where they had a call center or reservation systems. It's been running on-premises for a really long time. And it's even not something that you'd want to take and shove into a virtual machine. You know, you got custom hardware, you got people that know how to run it. I'm not going to go rewrite it. But when you think about it with mobile, now I get to the point where how do I provide a phone application that allows you to actually connect to the thing and be able to actually, you know, use it, right? I mean, I want to have that, and I can't rewrite all of it. And so that's a good example where being able to use existing software, but being able to bridge it back up into the client is actually important to this kind of flexibility thing, okay? Let me show you that real quick, actually, because I think it's actually, I'll show you a demo of exactly that. One of the features that we've got for Service Bus is the Service Bus Relay. We'll take this. So let me show you this. So grab your device. Everybody have Wi-Fi connection? This address, which is right here, see that address? Okay, that, get a browser open, put that into your browser, like literally right now. Grab everything, put it in there, try it out. So let's try this as an example. Okay, so what we want to be able to do, let's simulate this thing. Let's say that I've got a... here, we'll go pull this up in Visual Studio. Not the notify source. Here we go. Now, here is an application where what I want to be able to do is say, hey, oh, can you see it? Yes, let me put it up there. This is the URL right here. HTTP, JSONZ message, .azurewebsites.net. So let's try this example. Okay. Let's say I want to do something where I've got on-premises software, already exists. I can expose a web API on top of it so I can gain access to it. But I've got to be able to tunnel through the internet. I'd like to hook up some kind of public points of presence. Could be a website, could be a mobile, you know, a device or that sort of thing as well. So let me pull up some code here. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually make my laptop that's sitting right here, I'm going to make this my on-premises machine. So you have to imagine a big rack with a big fancy piece of software. Now, what I'm doing here is I put a service bus relay up into the Azure public cloud. That means it's an addressable endpoint that I can actually access from on-premise. So I can use my existing on-premises, pretend that this console app is my call center application. And all it's going to do is it's going to connect up to Azure and just read the queue and say, hey, when people ask for stuff, go pull the message off the queue and go ahead and do something with it. And ours is going to be really, really simple. We're basically just going to come in and we're going to take a message body that somebody posts and we're just going to print it out to the console. So I'll go ahead and launch this guy. And it's quite literally a console application. So what this is doing is I'm now starting up. You can see, hopefully you can read that, where it basically says, hey, I'm starting to listen to what you're doing. That means I'm on premises, and I'm listening to stuff up in the cloud to see what the heck's going on. Oh, you figured it out already. Awesome. So how do we do that? Well, okay, now I'm going to flip back over here. What the heck do we do with that thing? Well, we got to have a website up here. So this is an ASP.NET application. This website here is just type a message. Let's go ahead and I actually have a version that's up and running. And that's the one that everybody's connecting to. I probably should have turned that off before I do the demo. It's not as much fun afterwards. But here's the existing version that's published, which some of you have hit already with a question mark. If I change this one over to Moscow, I can go ahead and do a build against it on my local machine. So here's my build. And then what I want to do is just publish. So I just right-click, and I'm going to say publish. And I've actually got it hooked up. You can see the original version has question. I'll go ahead and do a publish here with ASP.NET. And this is part of what we saw this morning. I did a check-in, it gets tested, etc. In this case, I'm just doing it directly so I don't have all the test cases hooked up. But we're actually publishing it back out to the site. And now I have the question for Moscow. Hit enter on that guy. Let's see. Here's my console app right here. I've seen that band. Let's see, there's my hello from Russia. So if you hit this, you can basically come through. There's a lot of fans of the band in there. Okay, great. That's the danger of doing a live demo and allowing people to write messages that can show up on your screen for anybody to go read. Yeah, good content. But I think what you can see there is this is just my laptop, right? But this same machine could be provisioned and running on my on-premise site. And so now that we've done this, if we flip this back over, I have my website. Here's the new version of it. And I just happen to have the website, so you can see the message came through. Now, imagine that this website was using Web API Controller, and what it was doing is exposing an API back that could now be used by all your mobile devices. So now I can start writing, in this case with EasyJet, I can start writing my mobile check-in application. And the nice part about this, I don't actually have to flow the data into the cloud. So imagine that application. I can now come in, launch the app, let's say it's on iOS, I pull up my airline reservation app, I can type in my frequent flyer number and say, show me my reservations. Well, all I'm going to do is go from Coco, on the iOS side. I'm going to pass the reservation along up to the web service. The web service is going to post to the queue, just like we did right here with just plain text. That queue message is now going to be read from the on-premises site, and it'll come back and say, let me read it. Boom, here's your data. It can pull it back out the other direction. So you're really only flowing the data that was asked for. So now when I do the check-ins, I can actually handle both. It's actually kind of powerful, because now I can utilize what I've already got. I'm putting a small amount of code in the cloud and a small amount of surface area, and I'm able to hook up all these other devices, in this case a website, and it's actually pretty straightforward. Now, of course, I could take that same app, and if I were ready, I could move the entire thing up into the cloud. Yeah, then I'd be off and ready to go. Okay, so hopefully that's a good example of that. The next questions here were around, hey, deploying complex versions, autopilot, or being able to pull up the other things and that kind of stuff. Let's start with the deploy the complex versions. So I think you saw, you know, the ability to be able to do easy deploy. So with the websites, you know, I just made a change, right click, do a publish, and go. That works perfectly fine for that application. It was a very simple application, not a very large one at all. Sometimes you may have applications that are short-lived. You may, for example, you know, you can create like a campaign website where a campaign could be a commercial thing for, you know, a soft drink company or, you know, take your pick, where its only job is to show up. It'll show up on commercials and advertising. People will go hit it. Learn a lot about it, and then it's going to be done. That can be a common scenario. That's a case where, you know, the overall development of the application is not huge. It might be a particular time. It's going to be very used a lot, and then I'm not going to use it again. In certain situations like that, what I just described with being able to right-click and publish, you know, use source control, the stuff we saw the demos on, is going to work great. We don't, obviously, deploy our stuff that way for the portal. As you can imagine, as the number of people go up, if the application starts to get used by millions of developers or applications hitting those APIs every day, that is not something that we want to just have every developer in their office doing a right-click, hitting deploy. The process we'd like, the kind of source control and continuous integration, is a good process. In that case, being able to make check-ins, they do get serialized by the build system. The build system is going to run all my test cases against it, and then it'll invoke the deployment engine. It's the same deployment engine. So when I right-click and hit publish, then the automated stuff that you saw in the demo this morning invokes the same deploy and pushes the same applications out there. So that's kind of the scenario we'd like to be able to enable. The question is, how do you do that? We're going to enable this stuff at three different levels. The first thing is all of our management APIs that we use internally are exposed via REST programming surface area. That means you can write any code that you want in order to automate things like creating virtual machines, you know, shutting them down, starting them up, deploying websites, creating any object that you saw in there. You can programmatically write applications that can do that. The next thing we have is PowerShell scripts. There's actually some helper libraries for things like Node. So if you'd like to use JavaScript to do the same thing, there's some libraries and some helpers and some scripts for that too. And they just sit on top of those same APIs. The third level up on the top is the portal. And the portal itself, again, it uses the same APIs. And so the goal is now, if you just want to do the right click, Visual Studio would be kind of adjacent to the portal. So the portal, Visual Studio, they can both hit the same thing. So we want to be able to do all those things. We mentioned the private cloud area. That's another place we're using System Center. There's another option that you have for being able to use it. So I think this is a pretty common pattern. You know, it's a separation of, you know, the kind of control plane API, being able to use the commanding interfaces, and then being able to have a GUI interface. You know, it's a nice kind of system to have that. So that's the underlying piece. Now, where are we at with this? In a few cases, we have, I think, a pretty good solution. Like the website solution that I just showed is probably one of our best because, again, it uses the same APIs, the same control flow. However, it is completely integrated with source control, it's completely integrated with testing. I really like that sort of system. And that's good. I think it's fair to say we still have a little bit too much heavy lifting for some of our other scenarios. And you know, we've got cases, I think that some partners had already mentioned in the room that they're providing solutions that make this easier, and I'm all for that. And then using the same interfaces and APIs that you can use for that. My goal over time, just so you know, is that I'd like to see all the most common scenarios get as easy as the kind of point and click or the kind of integration components that are out there. And right now there are cases where that's probably harder than it should be. But you will see us add more and more productivity. And the strategy will match what you saw with ASP.NET. So we'll be able to have automated tools. We'll be able to hook it into the developer operations, the continuous deployment pieces. We'll hook all that stuff up. So we have actually some pretty sophisticated examples. Dev test is a common one where people have entire systems that are designed to go off and allocate a new set of virtual machines, put hardware, the software, the new versions of that against those machines, and run all their test cases, grab all the results, tear it back down, and throw those back out. And there are partners that can help with that same sort of technology. technique as well. And so I think, you know, it's a good kind of solution. This is an area that I think is very welcome to have solutions that people are putting together, both partners and Microsoft on top of it. And in often cases, it may match a particular environment in which you work in. I mentioned the ASP.NET websites. That's a good environment. Some of the Node environments is very similar as well. So you'll be able to see that. So if you don't see something where it's like, hey, I just wanted to right-click this big environment and just have it work, chances are we're already actually, you know, working on that in already. Okay, last question in this list, and then I'll take any follow-ups that folks have. And it doesn't have to be about Azure either. If people are interested in other stuff, just let me know. Last question that we had was around internal usage of Azure. A couple different things. One, we are using the same physical infrastructure across Microsoft. And so the pieces of software that I mentioned that do things like manage our physical machines worldwide, things like being able to power them up and down, track which ones are where, deploy host operating systems, these sorts of things, that is software that we actually share around the entire company. Now, a lot of our software for services, we've actually been building for over 10 years. So if you take something like, you know, Outlook.com, if you take, you know, we've got SkyDrive, you've got Xbox Live. I don't know if we have avid gamers here, but Xbox Live, you know, it's been around for a while. Windows Live and the identities, the Microsoft ID systems. So these systems are things we've been developing for over 10 years. What that means is a lot of that existing software was built with its own custom software too. Now, a bunch of this is moved over onto our underlying pieces. The bottom pieces will start off at the physical management. Now, what you're starting to see, now that we've got Azure and we've made it available, you know, both internally and externally, we have a lot more teams that are actually moving their next versions of their software on top of Azure. I mentioned Xbox because it's probably a good example. The Xbox One was announced last week. If you're an avid gamer, hopefully you're very excited about that. You probably also saw the Xbox team talk about the new online services, the next version of Xbox Live that goes with the new console. We have a significant investment in a bunch of that new code on top of the Azure platform, using a combination of things like tables, storage, you know, those sort of systems as well. And so, you know, if you log in and you're playing cloud games, you know, you're going to wind up with there's a storage account under there, and it's storing data, you know, across that system. So that's just one example, because the question is, hey, who's using it internally? So we've got significant, you know, adoption coming through with a bunch of our properties. And what you'll see is internal teams, they're very much like what you would do for your company. You're probably not going to get an opportunity to go rewrite all your software next week. That may be fun. Sometimes it's good to be able to start with a clean slate. It's just not realistic either. And so what we're seeing is people using the lower parts of our stack in order to bootstrap themselves and get to a common base that helps them. Common hardware management is a great example. And then as they do new versions, and I just used Xbox as an example, they have an opportunity with the next version of the software to start adopting more of the public interfaces that we have to just go use these big systems. We have massive uptake of that internally. I had mentioned this morning that we are doubling our capacity every 6 to 9 months. That means in the next, you know, 6 to 9 months, we're going to add twice as many cores, compute cores out there, and we're going to triple the amount of storage that we have in the system. That's a significant uptake. Now, that's a combination of some of these big internal customers that I just mentioned, internal to me, was Microsoft internal folks, but then also the external adoption that comes through. So it's a pretty big undertaking for those. So that's what the space kind of looks like. It's evolving fast. Personally, I'm very excited to be part of it. The last time I had a chance to be in a V1 was when I worked on the CLR, and it's hard to believe, but that actually was 96 when we started typing in the CLR and building up .NET. And then Visual Studio, et cetera. So it's a very cool time to be a developer. To me, you know, the technologies that are super interesting, we've got the cloud, that's changing a bunch of stuff. I mean, the IT industry is a $1 trillion industry. That's trillion with a T. It's lots and lots and lots of zeros. That's how much money is spent on hardware and software and consulting and everything for IT. That's a huge space. So the disruption that comes with the cloud is a massive opportunity. The proliferation of devices, having devices worldwide connected everywhere, you know, bunch of them in your pockets, the app stores that are coming through, huge. That's just really an awesome opportunity to look at the next version of software. And then we've got a bunch of really cool new programmatic stuff. So if you're a geeky developer, man, who doesn't want to write distributed applications? It's a lot of fun. There's a bunch of cool stuff in there. That plus big data in the analytics side is huge. There's a huge opportunity there for putting together interesting decisions around all sorts of data that you may not have seen before. We use that internally ourselves. So being able to see access patterns across the cloud, how to optimize networks based on this. There's all sorts of things. Software-defined networking. And the other one I would mention is machine learning. Machine learning is absolutely huge. So just like you see simple examples, recommendation engines, you know, people that like this music will like this kind of music. Those are just a start. We're going to see a significant explosion of this kind of technology as it goes forward. So it's actually really cool. It's a great opportunity to be part of that. All right. So that was the list. We have a couple of minutes left. Any follow-up questions that anybody has? Or did I? Yes, sir. Who's got the mic? Microphone, right over here. I'm sorry. He flinched. See, at an auction, that means you bought it.
Okay, so I just wanted to come back to my original question. Is it Azure for ASP.NET or ASP.NET for Azure? Or I know that the answer is that somehow balanced. Can you tell us a little bit more of how you balance this, like the priorities here of how do you drive those two systems who work together in concert?
Yeah. Okay, so take these off a second here. So we are building ASP.NET, and ASP.NET is a great example of a system that we're investing to work on the CloudOS. In other words, we have the same version that can run in Azure that we have that can run on Windows Server, or in the kind of private cloud sort of scenario. So we have a team that's dedicated to just constantly improving, that system. You've seen the latest versions of MVC that have come out, the Web API controller content over the last couple of years, another good example of that. We actually open sourced a bunch of ASP.NET because we actually wanted to also have the community be able to contribute. And if you wanted to see bug fixes or features faster, you want to move, really fast on that stuff. So we're full steam ahead on that. We're investing a significant amount of resources into .NET, into ASP.NET, and we're going to keep going after all of that. There is another part of the ASP.NET team that concentrates on the technology for doing the hosting piece, right? So just like you can go in and deploy IIS, you can add .NET and ASP.NET, and you can control the entire thing. You can do that. What we wanted to do was to make this website's feature, the one you see in the portal, we want to make that super easy. That means we can go in and manage the set of VMs. We can give you a multi-tenant solution, so we can pack more of them in. Helps you with the cost and that kind of stuff. Then also the kind of web deploy framework. So there's another part of the team that concentrates on that. That technology is designed to run both in Azure, and that's why you can go up to the Azure public site, do create website, use Visual Studio and publish. But it also runs on the private cloud, which means that we do have the ability to do the same sites and be able to go run those things. So it's a good kind of back and forth. So in that case, we're absolutely invested in ASP.NET. And we're investing in the website content to be able to go off and create that. What we may do internally is we may have different versions that we implement internally to help, because the scale that we run in Azure and run worldwide is different than the one we run in the private cloud. So there's other places where we'll kind of combine the two. So we're full steam ahead on investment. I hope that answers your question. Is it sort of? Okay, come find me afterwards. I'm not sure if I got it just right or not. All right. Any additional questions? No? Okay. See, he stood up. He flinched. Okay.
Just follow up on the previous answer. I'm not sure if it was
sure.
Right now, there are two published technology that Microsoft supports. Right now, you can publish into Azure, into a proper PaaS, as well as Web Deploy. Both technologies, if you look underneath, is essentially a zip over some kind of folder structure. Are you planning to ultimately I'm oversimplifying it. Are you planning to ultimately kind of merge web deploy and the endpoints for private clouds with public PaaS kind of CS package format and the protocol?
Mm-hmm. See, that's not fair because Victor's actually in the DevDiv team. So he works for Microsoft. So I should be asking you what, you know what, no. Because, yeah, I mean, our plan on this one, yeah, Victor's right. I mean, we have the web deployed technology. That's the piece that I was mentioning that works in both of these scenarios. So it's easy to deploy back and forth between those. And over time, you know, what he's basically saying is, hey, do we get to the point where we can, you know, kind of make that even higher fidelity? And the answer is yes. Right, so right now, web deploy is going to work in both. I can get my sites actually deployed on both sides. But then we'll, you know, of course, over time, try and make these even simpler, even easier. And that kind of provides you that flexibility that I was talking about, too. Just kind of a point in time thing. So, awesome. Last question right here. Yes, you win. Your last question.
It's kind of question, again, about your roadmap. I can see that Azure portal growing constantly, with respect to infrastructure as a cloud. For example, I migrate all my data center in Windows Azure, but in IIS, and I have a lot of different typical workloads there: SQL Server workloads, Exchange workloads, etc. Will I be able to manage it and to monitor it from Azure portal, not using some additional software, additional services, but directly from portal?
Yes, and the short answer to your question is yes. And what you see that we have today, we have some of the basic, you know, sort of content in there and ready to go. We give you counters, we give you the logs, you can grab those sort of components. I think over time, the thing that we'd like to be able to do is to provide even more analytics and more kind of default things. Because we have all sorts of internal tools that we use. We actually have a prototype of, in preview, HD Insight, which is a version of Hadoop that you can actually run on Azure. It's another example I didn't talk about, but if you want to go run, you know, 100 nodes of Hadoop and run a Pig or a Hive job on it, you can absolutely do that. Another good example of doing log analysis, getting alerting back, and then finishing that entire cycle. I think you should expect us to continue to invest in that space, and you're starting to see more of it come in. And the probably most interesting for you is that's the stuff that Victor actually works on. So if you turn right around, the guy right behind you is in charge of figuring that out. So if you have good ideas, guy in the blue shirt, make sure you tell him exactly what you're looking for, because we are working on some stuff that'll help. All right, with that said, thank you very much.
Прими прошлое, но живи здесь и сейчас. Пепси. Живи здесь и сейчас.
Желаю яства к пенному от купцов немецких. Так, холодец. Хрена маловато. В темницу. Этот мясо пожалел. В Сибирь. Молись, холоп. Вкуснота-то какая. Хрустота.
Новый вкус от Хрустим. Прекрасное сочетание холодца с хреном.
Хрустят все!
Новый Хрустим к пенному. Холодца и хрена в самый раз.